I'm a stranger here, Lord. I'm a stranger everywhere. I'm a stranger here, Lord. Stranger everywhere. Gal, I could go home, but I'm a stranger there. Ain't it hard to stumble when you've got nowhere to fall? Ain't it hard to stumble, Lord, when you've got nowhere to fall? When this whole wide world,
the late folk singer Ritchie Havens with I'm a Stranger Here. It's from his now rare album, Electric Havens, which was released in 1966. Ritchie Havens made his own history with his spectacular performance at Woodstock in 1969. He helped to give folk music, or message music as I call it, renewed respect and popular appeal. He died of a heart attack at his home in Jersey City, New Jersey, on April the 22nd, 2013. He was 72 years old. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And we return to our discussion yesterday, and with a different angle to it today. Today is a great day of irony and contrast in Israel, the way it's been since 1948. The decimated Palestinian population somberly commemorates Yaum al-Nakba, the day of the catastrophe. Marking the anniversary of this day in 1948, when more than 700,000 Palestinians were expelled from their homes and forced to flee their ancestral land. It is also a festive day for the nation today, called Israel, Palestine, up until 70 years ago, was born out of war, and Israel became a state, a Jewish state. Today's observances take place against a backdrop of blood and brutality as Palestinians bury their dead, almost 60 of them now, including children, according to reports, who, through protest, were calling attention to the decades of suffering they have endured under apartheid Israeli rule and control. I have the pleasure of conversing today with my friend Gilbert Messier, the founding editor of the and editor-in-chief, of News Junkie Post. He's also an international journalist, photojournalist, and filmmaker, and he's the author of the Orwellian Empire, a book about the ravages of global corporatism. So thanks for being with us, Gilbert.
Thank you for having me, Utrecht. It's always my pleasure to be on your show, even so it's on in many ways a very somber occasion as Gaza is burying their dead, and as the Middle East, the overall region could get into even bigger trouble.
I was so upset yesterday, really. It suddenly came over me, you know, seeing these people just like just shooting ducks and children and mothers running everywhere frantically trying to find one another in the middle of all of this firing of bullets that were approved.
I think I was.
Hello?
I'm
here. Yes, I was saying I was sure that something would intervene and the conscience of the world would be directed at the government of Israel for undertaking this. What we saw was just a horrific drama. And my surprise, there were few criticisms and so forth, but you know, for the most part, it was accepted that you know this is Israel; it has a right to do what it wants to do within its borders. And one of the things that it has a right to do is to shoot people who it sees as being a threat to its general safety.
Well, it's kind of changing actually today, Utrecht, and I think that
yes.
I'll give you a couple of examples here. South Africa and Turkey have recalled the ambassador. Ireland and Belgium have summoned Israeli ambassador to the respective country to express their outrage. The global community is really up in arms, and it's not only people like you and I and that are extremely upset. And one has to say for your listener that this has been going on for 6 weeks, and it's not only the 60 Palestinians that got killed yesterday and 2,700 injured, most of them with a bullet wound in the legs and some of them with tear gas. It's overall 110 Palestinians that have been killed by snipers since 6 weeks, since the protest for the right to return have started. Now, and there's about more than 10,000 Palestinians injured. Now, just to give a perspective to your listeners in terms of cold numbers here, overall, 50%, that is 50% of Palestinians are more or less refugees, okay, since 1948. Only one, and that's 5.8 million. Only 1.8 million Palestinians have Israeli citizenship right now. There's 4.8 million in the occupied territory in Gaza, and 5.8 million are refugees in countries, mainly Jordan, but also Lebanon and Syria. Now, also, you know, we're talking about the 70 years anniversary, but I would like to sort of make an historical note here, because the real process didn't start in 1948. It started right after, in the aftermath of, actually before the end of World War I, November 2nd, 1917, by what is called the Balfour Declaration. And the Balfour Declaration was written by Balfour, who was the foreign minister of the British government. Palestine used to be part of the Ottoman Empire before the end of World War II. And I think that the document is very, very short, and I think it has to be read, you know, in its entirety, because it's very, very telling. And it was addressed to Lord Rothschild, and this is what it said. Dear Lord Rothschild, I have such pleasure in conveying to you, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavor to facilitate the achievement of this object. It being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, other rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. I should be grateful if you would bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation. Now, this is extremely telling because you have an element here, which is the fact that Israel, even according to this document, was not supposed to be a state of exclusion, was not supposed to be a Jewish state or religious state. See, this is kind of the problem here. It's obviously not a problem for the Trump administration or Zionists, because that's what they wanted. But this is the core problem of the endemic crisis in the Middle East since 1948. It's this notion here that 4% of Palestine in 48, which was the Jewish population of Palestine at the time of the Ottoman Empire, were let by the British Empire for financial reasons because of a loan from the Rothschild to the British Empire, to the British Crown, to claim a piece of land that were not there to start with. So, you know, this is where we are now. And of course, you add to the situation the Trump administration, who more or less obviously take instruction from various interests, and whatever Israel wants, Israel gets. So you have that. You have something that is highly symbolic and a provocation, a complete provocation of moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem with a lot of hoopla. That was yesterday. And what is that for exactly throwing oil on the fire of the Middle East? Because your listener might not know, but one of the most holy sites of Islam, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, is in East Jerusalem. And the move of the U.S. Jerusalem from Tel Aviv, who was overwhelmingly condemned by the international community, from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, is an attack on what has been the goal of all the negotiation for peace in the Middle East, which is a two-state solution. And let me tell you this, Utris, the two-state solution is still in favor of a majority of Israelis and a majority of Jews. See, the Netanyahu administration and the Likud and people like Avigdor Lieberman do not represent the will of most Jewish people. This is what people must understand.
When we saw what we saw yesterday, from your perspective, you've just outlined a bit of history, but from your perspective, what was the intention?
The Netanyahu administration and the IDF claim, they call, and it's a very easy way to dehumanize people, they call the peaceful protesters, some of them women and children, terrorists. Okay? Either they call them terrorists, or they say they're manipulated by Hamas, which they consider, just like the U.S., as a terrorist organization. Just like they consider Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. But the problem resides in this. Hamas was elected democratically by the Palestinians. Hezbollah, who now has the majority in Lebanon, is an elected government, you see? So many people in the Arab world, they call Israel a terrorist state. I'm not saying that, but there, this is the way they view Israel. What Israel is doing is actually harmful for Israel and harmful for Jews. It's an isolation. They're doing like South Africa did before the end of apartheid. And if it wasn't for the support of, you know, the United States of America, which in a way has sort of become, in many, many ways, sort of United States of Zionism, they couldn't have it this way. They would have to, but you see, pressure coming right now. They've been denounced. I mentioned Turkey, South Africa, but they've also been denounced very firmly by the UK, France, and so on. Israel, because of Netanyahu, because of what they're doing, because of the Trump administration, Israel and the United States, as a matter of fact, are getting isolated. They're trying to isolate other countries such as Iran or Russia, but as a matter of fact, it's sort of like a boomerang effect. They're trying to isolate countries, but they are getting isolated. And it's becoming obvious.
You know what? I was transported back to the, you know, not outside of the moment, which was tragic enough. It had a curious impact on me because it brought me directly to the experience of so many peoples across the world who, for one reason or the other, were targeted and dispossessed of their own land and made to live as second and third class citizens in their own land. And it struck me so hard because it's reliving the same story over and over again, except here we have a group of people who, back in 1948, decided to predicate their actions on something that is not provable, that God gave this land to them, and therefore they were entitled to take possession of it by every means necessary.
But you see,
we saw that in South Africa. We saw that in so many places around the world where people are just trying to live their lives. And for some reason, people concoct very elaborate schemes to annihilate them, to take their land. This is the whole point. I was so depressed about it.
But you see, Eutrice, there's a psychological and philosophical angle here. And I think you might have read a commentary that I did a few years ago about this the psychological aspect of things, where I basically sort of mentioned that the from the action of the state of Israel. The Jewish people have moved from being horribly abused, of course, during World War II, to being the abusers now of the Palestinians, that they have managed to completely dehumanize. And I have to tell you an anecdote here. You know, I used to live in Los Angeles, and I had an Israeli mechanic, and I consider them to be good friends. They were partners, and one of them spoke French. They were both Sephardic Jews. They were not Ashkenazi, because that's another problem with Israel. The majority of the one moving are Ashkenazi Jews from Eastern Europe, not the initial population of Sephardic Jews. Anyway, they were Sephardic Jews, and of course they had both fought in the Israeli army, because it's mandatory. And one day, we always talk politics, and we were talking about Palestinians. And he explained to me, his name was David, he explained to me that in his mind, if the Palestinian killed one Israeli needed to kill 10 Palestinians, because Palestinians were sort of like cockroaches. Now, this is something that is not acceptable, and this is something that is very similar to the vision of humanity that somebody like Adolf Hitler had. So to be, you know, people that abuse people, like individually, okay, psychologically, it's known that abusers were usually abused. But collectively, it doesn't give the right to a nation to do that. This is basically the point that I was making in this commentary about abuse. But the thing is, in terms of geopolitical aspect, the isolation, Israel is really treading dangerously here, because, as I mentioned earlier, Hezbollah has no majority in Lebanon. Palestinians, there used to be a lot of Palestinian refugees in Syria. They are fighting with Bashar al-Assad. So they are getting a lot of military training and so on. Jordan has more than 2 million Palestinians, and Jordan are not extremely friendly with Israel anymore. So in terms of the antagonism that they're creating regionally, it could turn very, very badly for them. So I think that the issue of Israel and what's really terrible for Israel is the current administration. And one of the reasons why Netanyahu as make those stand and as this sort of incredible inhuman policy is to sort of like make kind of hide the corruption scandal that are affecting him. It's sort of a wag the dog, you know, a strategy in a way, but I don't think it's going to work. I think in the medium term, something will have to give. And and as far as the Trump administration, well, whatever they do to provoke other country and insult other country, the last time I was on the show, we were discussing President Macron's trip to the U.S. And President Macron was insulted by Trump in terms of getting out of the Iran deal. You see, the thing is, again, as I said, Israel right now and the United States are isolating themselves from the international community, and Americans and Jews will pay the price economically, politically, and in terms of global influence.
Well, they don't care about that because they have, it appears, an unending supply of money. They have their availability, an army, a navy, an air force. They have the backing of very wealthy Jews from New York and from other parts of the United States who will supplement any kind of deficit that they have and who are committed, absolutely committed, no matter what, to supporting a government even when that government is shown to be what it is. You know, it's a killer regime.
Absolutely, absolutely. But you are saying absolutely the absolute truth, Utrecht, in terms of the financial backing of the of the state of Israel. Of course it is. And it's not only financial backing, which is expressed, of course, in that original, you know, Balfour Declaration to Rothschild. So it's been going on for more than 100 years, and it's still going on. But they also have a lot of Western media playing in their favor. The thing is, you know, I will be, people will say when they listen to the show, they will call me because I'm critical of Zionism and of the policy of Israel, that I'm anti-Semitic because that's what they do. That's part of the strategy. But that has nothing to do. One has nothing to do with the other. You know, you can perfectly be extremely critical with the policy of Israel and specifically Netanyahu, and not be anti-Semitic at all, you know. But it's just the problem is I don't think they will win eventually because it's kind of the law of the number, and they're also messing with countries that have regained a lot of strength, and I'm talking specifically about Turkey. Okay? Turkey, who used to be the Ottoman Empire, control the entire region, Syria, Iraq, Palestine, Saudi Arabia. And they have an army that is not to be, they cannot be discounted as a joke. You see, the U.S. and Israel, they set themselves up to have Israel as the biggest military country in the region. This is changing, okay? It's changing because of Iran and because of Turkey, okay? Because of Iran and their allies, which are Hezbollah and potentially Iraq. So they do not have they do not have the advantage of the number, and they are losing the global public opinion. They making martyrs is never good. And it's very, very smart on the part of Hamas and the Palestinian protesters to have actually been completely peaceful. It is extremely smart because that's all you gain. That's how you gain global public opinion. That's what somebody like Mahatma Gandhi did, or Martin Luther King in the U.S. That's how you gain public support.
I'm surprised that we haven't really seen this issue come up in Congress as a matter of some degree of urgency, considering that we had the United States as a pivotal actor in this whole thing. The decision to move its embassy, despite objection in the world community of nations, which basically pointed out that this was what was going to happen. It was going to provoke a very violent reaction, and they interpreted the move by the United States as exactly that, an act of provocation. I would think that given the outcome so far, which is bad enough, and the idea that it could get even worse, right, I would think that there would be in Congress a very hurried set of meetings looking at the conduct of the president, who in acting the way he did and acting the way he does seems to think that this is all his business. It doesn't affect anybody else, right, and he doesn't want anybody else involved.
Right.
Does it surprise you that we don't have emergency meetings being called considering the severity of the act by the Israeli government, which is, of course,
no,
supported by the U.S. government?
No, it doesn't surprise me at all. And the answer resides in an acronym that is called AIPAC, a very powerful organization that financed the campaign of all the people in the Senate and a lot of people in Congress. Okay? It's an organization that is financed by Jews and by Israel, and it's an organization. Now, you see, the problem is this, you know, everybody, the Democrats, they've been talking about collusion of the president with Russia and Putin and all this rubbish, all this nonsense. But the real collusion here with a foreign nation is the collusion of U.S. government, one after another, maybe at the exception of Jimmy Carter, with the Jewish state of Israel. Okay? That's the real collusion. That's the real problem. The problem is a foreign country, through AIPAC, okay, finance politicians, very, very largely finance politicians and get them elected. That's why, Utrecht, and you know that perfectly well, you don't have those conversations in Congress, and you don't have them much in U.S. media, mainstream media either. I'm sure you remember that, but on CNN, I think it was during the Obama era, one of the, I think it was, his name was David Sanchez or something like that, was critical in, you know, on air of the state of Israel. He got fired within a day. You know, it's just, you cannot say anything. You know, it's kind of a taboo in the U.S. in the media, and you know, you basically lose your job if you are officially critical like that. So it's not a surprise. The talking point is that Hamas, the talking point from Netanyahu government, who has become the talking point of the Trump administration and Fox News, Hamas is a terrorist organization, and they basically dispatch protesters who are not really peaceful protesters, they're rioters, and therefore Israel is defending itself and its border. This is the rationale. Of course, it is completely sick. It is completely sick, and it's just an outrageous breach of the most basic international law and human rights.
I've always said that people would be mistaken to believe that Netanyahu enjoys total support from Jews in Jews in Israel, that there was a very healthy movement critical of his government protesting and trying to find ways to extricate the country from the embarrassing and illegal position that it had been practicing, keeping its thumb on the Palestinians. What happened to that movement now? Is it, and where will it go now in the face of developments as of yesterday?
Well, it's interesting that you say that. And Netanyahu, I have a lot of Jewish friends and a lot of Israeli friends. And there's a lot of Jews that are completely disgusted by the policy of Israel and the policy, of course, of the Likud party and Netanyahu. When David Ben-Gurion, who made the declaration of the State of Israel, is kind of the founding father of the State of Israel 70 years ago, his goal was that Israel would become, quote unquote, a normal country. It's still not a normal country because of the occupied territory, because of Gaza. Okay? It is not a normal country at all. It's a country that is based on treating a lot of these people not even like second-class citizens. Like the people in the occupied territory in Cisjordania, they don't even have a country, and they're under the control of the Israeli army. They are occupied, you know. So it's not a normal country. The only way, and everybody knows that, from Jimmy Carter to John Kerry, was and is a two-state solution, with the capital of Palestine being East Jerusalem. But, you know, Netanyahu doesn't want that. And the U.S. administration, the current U.S. administration, either doesn't want that or do not understand that it is imperative, or, which is actually the case, are in the back pocket of Zionist interest.
But still, what becomes of the movement? Because there was a movement in Israel calling the government to account, seeking ways to ameliorate the situation, working with Jews outside of Israel and other people, not just Jews, but working with activists outside of Israel to kind of ratify a people's counter movement.
Right. But sorry to interrupt you, Tris. What I think that Netanyahu is trying to do, just like with Iran, just like what the U.S. is trying to do with Iran and Netanyahu, because that's kind of dictated by Netanyahu anyway, is to provoke Palestinians into retaliation, into violent retaliation, which in return will justify an even more violent retaliation from the Israeli army. It's a provocation. They are trying to become, to sort of, they're calling the victim the attacker. They want the victim to retaliate violently, either Palestinian or Hezbollah, or the force of Bashar al-Assad or Iran, so they can go full-blown ballistic. And I mean ballistic literally, because another little problem of the region is the fact that Israel has 250 nukes, okay? Which nobody really, you know, say they don't have it. Some say they do, but they have it. So, and it's the only country in the region that has nuke right now. And unfortunately, by looking at the behavior of Netanyahu and Avigdor Lieberman, his foreign minister, formerly minister of defense, no, actually the other way around, I think that this specific government would not hesitate at using those nukes on Iran or Syria. This is what I think. I hope it doesn't come to that. But, you know, hopefully Jewish people worldwide and Israeli people will eventually get rid of Netanyahu, vote him out. I mean,
the hope is that that would also apply here in the United States and elsewhere, where the heads of state are firmly on the side of Israel. What,
absolutely,
therefore, do you see applying this same analysis that you just offered here? How would it play out in the United States?
Well, look, I mean, in the U.S. right now, you have somebody that is unbalanced, that is sort of not really in control, not even of himself, I think, which is Donald Trump, obviously. The new people that have his ears are sort of very, very scary people who are also a little unbalanced as well, which is specifically John Bolton and Mike Pompeo. Those people are kind of scary. So this is the problem that we're facing here. And I'll tell you, I think that the sanction on Iran, which they are doing, because, you know, the agreement is not going to be, the agreement is gone, at least with the U.S. Maybe Europe, Western Europe, that is, of course, mainly France, Germany, and the U.K., but also the complete EU, are going to start putting their foot down vis-a-vis the U.S. administration, vis-a-vis their foreign policy, and just said, we are not going to go along. We are not going to let you scrap France as a giant energy company, Total, at a $5 billion deal for gas exploitation in Iran. Airbus was supposed to sell $1 billion worth of airplane to Iran. Those are like jobs in France and elsewhere in Europe, and they are not going to go along. I mean, they're going to have to start to understand that their interest, their national interest, that is, do not align with either the U.S. or the state of Israel. They have to understand that.
Well, here's another interesting element, and that is the Asian element. Trump is trying to curry favor and to develop healthy trade and other relationships with China and South Korea and North Korea, and they have a history of authoritarianism, so they are likely to not be so critical of Netanyahu's move. Do you think that they would, in this instance, look very differently at the subject because it might raise questions about their past, and it might raise questions about their willingness to depart from their past? And instead, you have business concerns, you have power concerns ruling, ahead of any opportunity to turn a leaf here and say, okay, yes, we know we've had totalitarian rule, but that doesn't mean that we continue to support it. We're moving away from that model into different models now. How do you think that would play out?
You know, Utrecht, I really think that a lot of people, a lot of analysts, a lot of commentators, it's kind of like they view finance and economical problem as the fundamental motors and vector of history. I do not think so. I think that your reaction when you opened the show, your shock, and when we briefly talked yesterday, This is what moved people. What moved people are emotions, are those kind of feeling that of compassion with other human beings. And I'll tell you something. Muslim Shia Sunni combined, it's more than 2.5 billion people worldwide. All the Muslim in the world are in uproar for what happened to the 60 Palestinians yesterday in Gaza. So this is what's going on here. This is about, you know, forget the economy situation, forget all the money and all that stuff. That's not what moved people. This is not what made the Cuban Revolution possible, or Mao Zedong Revolution possible in China, or the one in Russia, or the one in France for that matter. It's when people start realizing that we are all the same, and we need to join together at some point to perhaps get rid of the parasites that are supposed to be in charge. This is what I'm getting at, and I don't know. You know, it could be a turning point. It is definitely, if you read the press today, it is definitely kind of a turning point, and I there's French newspapers that are usually very, very cautious and more like pro-Israeli. Today they are not. So it could be a turning point, you know. In the U.S., not so much, because, as I said, the pro-Israeli interests are so entrenched in the U.S., in the government and also Wall Street, as you mentioned, that and in the media, that it's probably going to be a lot slower. But again, what happened yesterday and what's been going on for like 70 years in the Middle East is not in the interest of Israeli people and Jewish people. This part of the world always had three religions, and curiously enough, you know, Palestine was a lot better off during the Ottoman Empire, which lasted 600 years. Those three communities were not at war. You had Muslim, Christian, and Jews, and things were not so bad.
Where do you think things are going to go now? I mean, there's a fallout effect. People are going to try emotionally and psychologically as best they can to cope with the reality that they have witnessed themselves. And they should start thinking about what is the next move. Tactically, what is the next move? The Israeli government's foot is on their neck. They have no intention of removing it. They have very staunch allies, and they have weapons, literally, of mass destruction. They have a way of defending themselves even beyond their internal so-called enemies. So what happens now? What do you think the thinking is right now in Netanyahu's circles?
Well, you know, the thing is, they do not care. There will be discussion at the UN, but I have to do another little historical reminder here. The right to return of the 750,000 Palestinians that were kicked out of their home in 1948 was recognized by UN Resolution 194, which was approved in December 1948. You see, so the international community at the time gave Palestinians the right to return. The state of Israel has been in breach thanks to the support of not only the U.S., but also the U.K., France, and so on, because of financial pressure, okay, from Jewish finance, okay, I have to spell it out, they have been in breach of international law for 70 years. Now, what's going to happen now, I think, hopefully, Palestinian people from Hezbollah, Lebanese from Hezbollah, and especially Syrian and Bashar al-Assad will not take the bait and really start to attack Israel. Because then, if they do that, all hell will break loose. And I'm not sure who can actually, you know, but you see, the U.S., because of the Trump administration, has lost any kind of credit to be a mediator in the Middle East. They have no credit anymore, zero. They didn't have much. But I'll tell you, you know, during the time of John Kerry at the State Department, and he was really running, you know, U.S. foreign policy, a lot more than Obama, John Kerry is in favor and was in favor of a two-state solution, and in 2015, he managed to broker the Iran nuclear deal. No, those were achievements. At the time, the U.S. still could pass for a mediator, but not anymore. So who's going to fill in the gap? You know, it could be the EU. It could be Russia a little bit, but it's a bad situation. It's a very, very bad situation geopolitically.
Well, you know, in more ways than one, because you're talking here about, I mean, when it comes down to it, the question of nationhood. And all nationhood rests on the possession and ownership of land. Here we have a people who systematically have been removed from their land, their ancestral lands. And now, and since then, and up until now, and I suppose for the foreseeable future, the plan is to frustrate them into annihilating themselves, just dwindling the numbers to the point where it makes no sense even to pretend the possibility of reforming a nation as they once knew it.
Why?
So this is why, you know, it was so reminiscent to me of what happened in South Africa and in many other parts of the world, where people systematically were removed from their land, all of the resources of the land taken away from them, and reduced not as full-fledged citizens of their own country, but as something else. And that something else would be even lower than animals.
Exactly.
I don't know where this is going, but the question has to be asked, what is the intention, and how will Palestinians, already way under stress, how do they mount a counteroffensive when they are weak, when they are overwhelmed, and when the opponents are so well-funded and so surrounded by other countries that have their back?
Well, the thing is, Utris, Palestinians have been used for decades as convenient pawn by the rich country of the Middle East, namely all the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia. Okay, so they've been used like pawn. Of course, they give them money, but it's always they keep them on the edge. You see, and right now we've got somebody, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, is good buddy with Israel, is good buddy with the Zionist plan, which is ultimately to carve a bigger chunk of land, and that's called the Greater Israel Project, and more or less split the region between the Greater Israel and Saudi Arabia, that nice little kingdom. You know, you see, so this is kind of the issue. But you see, to go back to my sort of World War II analogy, the state of Israel is treating the Palestinian very much like Jews were treated during World War II. They are barely human for Israeli, you know.
We have to leave it there, I'm afraid. We run out of time. And I could listen to your analysis all day. So another time we'll finish off this conversation, but I want to thank you for being with us today, Gilbert, and for giving us the benefit of your insights in this region. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. You, Trace, always a pleasure.
Thank you. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Infectious Myth with David Crowe.
Ain't it hard to stumble